Okay, we are running a little late. This talk is supposed to start at 4, and we're going to start probably at around 4:20. The bus schedule has been revised. The first one is, because we're running a little late, the first one is going to leave here at 5:45, and then they're going to run thereafter. So don't feel that you need to rush out of here at 5 o'clock to make the buses back to the hotels that you're staying at. Okay, so we have taken care of that for you. You will have some time afterwards still to mingle a little bit. Our final talker today is by Joe Polchinski. Joe is one of the very eminent four permanent members of the ICC faculty here. Joe is an expert in string theory and quantum gravity. In fact, he's recently written a graduate level textbook on the subject, which he wanted to call Joe's Big Book of String. Unfortunately, his editors at Cambridge University Press forced him to call it the String Theory. And, but Joe has been working in this area for a long time, and string theory, as he will tell you, is probably our best hope of becoming the theory of everything, a theory which unifies all the fundamental interactions of physics. And as Kip, Roger, and even Stephen have been talking about, Joe has been given very high expectations on your part to try and explain this to you in the next hour. And his talk is entitled, "What is string theory, and what does it have to do with black holes?"
Thank you, Omar. Okay. So I have three very tough acts to follow and a lot to tell you about. I had a lot to tell you about even before Kip started making these extravagant promises on my behalf. Actually, the change of schedule is very nice because you may have noticed that Stephen Hawking answered almost all of the questions that Kip said that I would answer, and I will actually repeat, maybe from a different point of view, some of the things that Stephen said. So what I have to tell you is, first of all, what is string theory? So I have to tell you not just about general relativity, the theory of gravity, but this other thing which is supposed to be the theory of gravity and everything else, and then what it has to do with the main subject of this meeting, which is black holes. Here's a more detailed outline. I want to talk about the search for the ongoing search for the basic building blocks of nature and how that has led us to this idea of string theory. Then about a conflict between two of the central laws of physics, the theory of general relativity and the theory of quantum mechanics, and how resolving this conflict leads again to this idea of string theory. Then a little bit about string theory as a scientific theory, because it's got some unusual features. And finally, what this all has to do with black holes. So one of the main goals of science over the years has been to find the smallest building blocks from which everything else is made. And what has happened again and again as more and more powerful tools have been developed is that once we thought we had a building block, a more powerful tool was able to look inside that building block and find out that it was made of still smaller things. So I want to take you through some of the previous steps in this series, starting with a smooth block of matter. So on the right here, I've given you the approximate size in centimeters of each picture. Starting with a smooth block of matter, you know that if you magnify it enough, it becomes apparent that it's an assembly of atoms. If you magnify a little bit more, you find out that each atom is a tiny solar system with electrons orbiting around a heavier nucleus. And we now have tools to magnify even further. If you magnify the electrons, well, today, as far as we can see, there is nothing else inside them. We can't see inside the electrons. They look like little points. But if you magnify the nucleus, indeed, a little further on, you find inside it neutrons and protons. And again, if you magnify one of these protons or one of these neutrons, you find inside it three quarks held together by a force that is sometimes called glue. And this is about where we are today. This is as far as the as particle accelerators can probe. So these two transparencies take you through over 100 years of scientific history at successively smaller scales. We see smaller and smaller things. And as you think about this, there are several questions that probably come to mind. First of all, is this the end? Have we reached, in fact, the end and found the final smallest building blocks here? Second, if not, what's next in this series? It's like one of those puzzles on a math test. And finally, is there an end? Do we have simply an infinite series of smaller and smaller different kinds of things that we would be able to detect with stronger and stronger tools? We don't know the answer to any of these questions because the experiments stop where I said. So we don't know for sure, but we have very good ideas. We think we know, and I'll try, among other things, to answer these questions. To start, let me give you a more complete list, picture of the building blocks as we know them today. There are those quarks. So this is the theory as we understand it today. It has the unexciting name of the Standard Model. Those quarks, which come in 18 varieties, 6 flavors and 3 colors, and why these properties are called flavor and color is just history. 6 different kinds of lepton, which includes the electron and the neutrinos. Something called a Higgs boson, and 4 forces, including gravity, the main subject today, as well as electromagnetism and the 2 nuclear forces. Now, this is a very successful theory. In the quarter century since it more or less took its final form, it continues to be entirely successful. These building blocks and these forces appear to account for all the physics, all the science that we can see, down from the smallest scales that are probed by particle accelerators and up to the longest distances that are probed in astronomy. So, is this the end? Are we done? Have we found those final building blocks? Well, the answer is surely we haven't. This is much too complicated. 18 of these and 6 of those and 4 forces, which are sort of alike in some ways but different in other ways. There's clearly a pattern here. There's a pattern like the pattern in the periodic table, and it needs some kind of explanation, an explanation in terms of smaller, simpler building blocks. So the answer to the first question is, that is this layer of structure the end? Is surely not. You can't look at this and say, this is the whole story. There's got to be something simpler. There's got to be some explanation for why certain numbers of things, and also for their detailed properties. What are their masses, and how do they interact with others? Now, since experiment right now stops here, this is what we know from experiment, to go to the next layer is primarily a theoretical enterprise, and we have a lot of clues. The main clues are the patterns that you see up here, the patterns in these particles. So one of the main goals at the next step is to explain the patterns in the Standard Model, and also, and I'll say a little bit more about this as we go along, to resolve some subtle mathematical and physical inconsistencies in the theory. Now, in the 25 years that theory has been in place, a lot of ideas have been tried for smaller building blocks, simpler ideas from which one could understand the diversity of different particles and forces that we had on the transparency before. In fact, I've named 3 of them here, and I'm committing a sin here in throwing jargon at you without explaining what it is. But I mention this because just to give you some flavor of what has gone on in terms of looking for new ideas. In particular, each of these 3 ideas that I've named up here appears to be successful in explaining part of the pattern. Each of them explains a different part. No one of these ideas explains the whole thing. All 3 of them together don't explain the full pattern, but each of them works well enough to have made us think over the years that, yes, this is a good idea, maybe this and something more. And in fact, what we've learned is that each of these 3 ideas turn out to be puzzle pieces which fit together in really an entirely unexpected way into this new thing. It's not that new anymore. It's almost as, well, not new at all. Um, But this new thing called string theory. So that's what I have to tell you about next. Okay, speakers also aren't supposed to hide parts of their transparencies. That's another sin, but just for a little while. So there's one of these quarks or leptons, and what you see up there is more or less what experiment tells you about. It looks like a tiny, tiny point. And the question is, suppose you could magnify it enough. Suppose you could magnify it enough, what would it look like? And many of the ideas that come to mind are sort of little solar systems, just like the atom turned out to be a little solar system, and the protons and neutrons are little solar systems of quarks. The first thing you would think of is some kind of little solar system-y thing inside. That's been tried in various different forms. Other things have been tried which don't have such simple pictorial explanations. And one thing has been tried which works remarkably well, and it's this, that if you magnify them enough, any of these things will look like a tiny closed loop called a string. Now, that's a strange idea. It's not the first thing you would think of, or even the second or the third, but somebody thought of it, they tried it, it worked, and after a while they convinced the rest of us. Now, there's a size here that we sort of know pretty well. We think we know pretty well. I'll tell you a little later where this number comes from, but these things are very small. That is 10 to the 17th times smaller than the previous picture. So these are extraordinarily small, far beyond the reach of any experiments of the usual type. So a little bit more about how this works. Okay, this string doesn't have a lot of properties. It has mass, it has tension, meaning like a violin string or a rubber band, it wants to collapse, but at the same time it has quantum effects. Quantum mechanics doesn't let it collapse, so it kind of sits there vibrating and oscillating. That's the main thing it does. It doesn't have a lot more properties than that, but that's enough. The reason that it's enough is because you can take this one building block, one now, not 18 or 6 or 4, and put it into different states of vibration. It has harmonics, like the harmonics of a violin string, even though its ends aren't held down. And you can excite each of those harmonics to a different degree. And strange though it sounds, depending on which of the harmonics are excited and how much by, this tiny thing, which again is living at those very, very tiny distance scales, if we look at it with, you know, the kinds of experiments that we do, it will have the properties of, it will just look just like a quark or a lepton or a Higgs particle, or one of the particles that are associated with each, in quantum theory, each of those forces has an associated particle, so it can also look like, depending on its state of vibration, a photon, graviton, gluon, or one of the other particles associated with one of the other forces. Okay, that sounds strange, but remarkably it works. The one other thing that these strings can do, besides just sitting there and vibrating in different ways, is that they can break in two or go in the opposite direction and connect together again. And all of the forces we see, the gravitational force that we've been talking about, the electromagnetic force, the nuclear forces, all are just this one process. This one process gives rise to all of them. So indeed, it's what one is looking for, one force or one process and one building block and everything else following from that. Now, I wish I could sort of tell you more about this, do a calculation or give you more detail to show you how this works, but sort of from this point on, one needs the full technical machinery, and there's not much more one can say in a simple way. If I tried to go further, it would lead to a 900-page book, and I don't want to do that again. I'll clean those up later. And just, again, a little bit of the history. This idea first took shape around 1974, the idea that these one-dimensional objects, these vibrating loops, could look like, especially gravitons, but like all the other particles. And most other physicists did not leap into this idea. There was a very long period here when only a small number of people, sometimes only three or four, were actively developing this idea. But around 10 years later, around 1984, the evidence became strong enough that most of the rest of us who were working on other things took notice, dropped what we were doing, began to work on string theory, and more or less haven't stopped since. Now there's another dot 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 here because of course this is still going on. String theory, it's clear, can explain the general patterns in what we know, the general patterns in the standard model, the general kinds of particles and kinds of forces. It doesn't yet give precise predictions, the precise numbers of each and their precise masses and other properties. So this is an ongoing theory with the goal being to actually end up with something that we can calculate. So that's the first part of my talk. String theory from the point of view of looking for the smallest building blocks. Now I was educated as a particle physicist, which means that this is my business, finding the smallest things inside of other things. If I had been educated instead as a general relativist, I would have started my talk in a very different way. So now let me go back to the beginning and give the talk that I would have given, or start the talk that I would have given, if I in fact had been a general relativist. In that case, I would probably begin by talking about the conflict between two of the central theories of theoretical physics, general relativity, Einstein's theory of gravity, and quantum mechanics, which is the basic theory of dynamics, which is particularly important for understanding the behavior of anything of atomic size and on down. These two theories both date from the early decades of the century. They're both enormously important, enormously successful, yet there is a sense in which they disagree with one another. Now, before I go on to describe that, let me say this is not an immediate problem because normally when you're talking about stars, big things, well, you need general relativity, but you don't need quantum mechanics. The quantum mechanics is a small effect. When you talk about atoms and other small things, you need quantum mechanics to understand their behavior, but general relativity doesn't matter. So in most normal environments, you're only using one or the other of these at a time, and so the conflict doesn't arise. But when you go into extreme environments, like the very early universe, very high energies, or a black hole, then in fact there are places where both theories are important, both at the same time, and now this conflict has to be faced and resolved by a better theory, a more complete theory that incorporates both of these. Let me try to describe that conflict. So, general relativity tells us that space-time can bend, and that's what gravity is. Quantum mechanics, well, quantum mechanics is pretty complicated, and Stephen Hawking actually wrote down some of the relevant equations, but I just want to pull out of quantum mechanics one of the central properties of it, the uncertainty principle, which says that at a microscopic level, nothing sits still. Okay, so we have these two facts, space-time can bend, and nothing sits still. And what this tells you is that space-time doesn't sit still. That while we're used to thinking of it as being sort of a given background, space and time, in which everything else moves, in fact, at some microscopic level, it looks more like this, with rapid quantum fluctuations. And again, this is normally not a problem, as I said, because normally you don't use quantum mechanics. You don't need to worry about quantum mechanics and general relativity at the same time. It's not a problem at 1 centimeter. You don't see space-time shaking. It's not a problem at particle accelerator distances. None of the physics that we see coming out of particle accelerators is sensitive to this shaking of space-time. You've got to magnify still further. And if you magnified, well, 10 to the 16 more times, the combination of the theory of quantum mechanics and the theory of gravity tells you that space-time would look something like this, with little ripples just all the time appearing and disappearing. Magnify a bit more, the ripples get bigger. Magnify a bit more, and the ripples are out of control. Space-time is oscillating by huge amounts. Very likely, little pieces are breaking off, holes are appearing, handles are appearing. This is a state that's called space-time foam. Okay. Space-time probably really doesn't do this. If space-time did this, even on these very, very short distance scales, it would be very hard to make sense of physics at all. Both mathematically and physically, this is very hard to deal with, and very likely that even if you could make mathematical sense of the theory, there would be unacceptable physical effects even on the much longer distance scales that we see. What this means, what this means is that the extrapolation of general relativity and quantum mechanics this far is probably wrong. There is some point, somewhat before this, actually probably just shortly before this, where something new comes in which in effect quenches the space-time foam and leaves you with a smoother space-time. I can tell you now, by the way, where this number comes from, this very short distance, 10 to the minus 33 or 10 to the minus 32 centimeters, that appears in string theory. There are three important constants of nature for discussing quantum mechanics and gravity together. H-bar, Planck's constant, which controls the size of quantum effects. G, the gravitational constant, which controls the strength of gravity and the speed of light. And each of these constants has units. It's some combination of grams and centimeters and seconds. But there's one combination of them. There's one combination of them which has precisely units of centimeters, which is a length, and that's known as the Planck length, and that's this very short scale. So this is the distance scale where both quantum mechanics and gravity, general relativity, are important together. And this is the calculation, and this is the picture that goes with it. And space-time foam probably doesn't make sense. We need to find some theory which it has to agree with general relativity in the areas where general relativity has been tested. It has to agree with quantum mechanics in the areas where quantum mechanics has been tested, and they've both been very well tested in their own areas. But at the same time, it has to somehow fix this problem, change the picture at these very short distance scales. That's not easy to do. You can't just go monkeying with things and not spoil something somewhere else. It's not easy to do at all. In fact, we know of only one way right now to combine quantum mechanics, and general relativity, and not run into this problem of space-time foam. And indeed, it is string theory. Now, I don't know exactly what picture to draw. Okay, this is a distance a little bit above the Planck scale where space-time isn't quite going crazy yet. And this is how big a string is supposed to be, a little bit bigger than the Planck scale. And the idea is that at distances smaller than the size of the string, you just don't talk about space-time. There's no way to measure it. It doesn't even really exist. Another way I could try to say this is, in string theory, gravity itself, space-time itself, is made of strings. So I should be trying to draw some kind of picture here where the whole space-time, in some sense, looks stringy. I don't know precisely what picture to draw, and that probably partly reflects the fact that our understanding of string theory isn't complete today, but that's the idea. That's the idea. The string has a size. It's a bit larger than that Planck scale. Beyond this point, there is no space-time, and there is no sense in which this space-time foam occurs. So this one idea, which on the one hand seems to be a natural unification, a natural explanation of the patterns that we see in the particle properties, also is the only solution we have today to this problem of space-time foam. By the way, independent of string theory, I asked three questions. The first was, are the building blocks we know today, the standard model, the final ones? And I think the answer is surely no. The second question was, what comes next? And again, I think the answer is very likely strings. And the third question was, is there an end? Or are we simply going to follow an endless chain of smaller things inside other things? And here is the answer. Here is the reason why the answer to that third question is probably also no. This problem of space-time foam seems to mean that distances shorter than the Planck length just don't exist. Beyond that distance, you can't make sense of space-time. The combination of the bending of space-time and quantum mechanics means that you just can't talk about length shorter than that. So there's just a place where distance doesn't mean anything, and you simply can't have anything smaller than that. So I think the answer to the third question is that, yes, there is an end. It's far away. It's far away. It's 10 to the 17th times smaller than the distances that we can reach today with accelerators, but there is happily an end. At least an end to this one direction of going to smaller and smaller and smaller things. Maybe there are other directions that we haven't thought about that will emerge once we understand the end of this particular direction of investigation. Okay, so that was my third topic, the conflict between general relativity and quantum mechanics. My fourth was to talk about sort of string theory as a scientific theory, to make a couple of points. The first is that string theory is very unusual because it is theory without ongoing experiment. It has to be this way. It has to be this way because, again, experiments have not yet seen inside quarks and leptons. And so we have no direct evidence that there are smaller building blocks, much less what they are. And so any attempt to understand what they are is going to be a theoretical enterprise. Also, fortunately or unfortunately, these strings are so very small that not only have we not seen them yet, but they'll never be seen directly. Any test of this theory will be an indirect one. We don't have ongoing experiments. We have past experiments. We have the experiments that led us to the standard model and the need still to explain what they found, but we don't have ongoing experiments. This is not only unusual, this is really unique. I don't think there is no place else in physics, in science, where you have active, lively theory without experiment. And indeed, this makes our colleagues very suspicious. And naturally so, because they know that in their areas of science, if someone turned off the data for a year, or in this case, 25 years, they would stop. They would, you know, make a theory and someone else make a different theory, and they'd elaborate, and soon you'd have 20 theories, and you would have no way to decide which is right. And that's the end. You would simply have to do something else until the data improves. That's normally what happens when you have science without data. It's not science. We've been very, very lucky. We've been very, very lucky in string theory because this hasn't happened. Instead, the many different directions, the many different lines of investigation that we followed to try to understand the things I've talked about, the patterns that we see, some of the problems with quantum gravity, instead of leading in 20 different directions, have done the opposite. They've converged on this one idea. And the slogan is, all roads lead to string theory. I've described some of those roads, and I'll describe some more. The first was the search for the attempt to understand the patterns in the standard model, and I've drawn not one arrow there, but three, to emphasize the fact that string theory incorporates, again, not one, but those three different previously existing ideas for understanding the patterns. Secondly, there are the conflicts between quantum mechanics and general relativity, and again, I've drawn several arrows. The one I've talked about so far is the problem of space-time foam, but there are others that I'll talk about before the end. And the third direction is the search for new mathematical tools. It's often been the case in the past that new physical theories have required new mathematics. Newton's laws of motion required calculus. Einstein's law of gravity required the mathematics of curved space, curved space-time. Someone at lunch mentioned group theory, which began as abstract mathematics and now plays a vital role in atomic and particle physics. And it's very likely true that the tools that we have today, the mathematical tools that we have today, are not enough to finish the job, are not enough to describe this complete and unified theory that we're heading toward. And if you ask mathematicians, if you look in mathematical literature at the most interesting, the most lively areas of mathematics, what you find more than once, in many, many cases, is that there are close ties between those areas of mathematics and things in string theory. And there are very close interactions now between string theorists and mathematicians, where the physics drives the creation of new mathematics, and the mathematics also helps us sort out the physics. Okay, so the first thing I want to say again is that string theory is unusual science. The second is that it's ongoing, it's evolving. It's not unlike most theories evolving in response to scientific experimental input. One way to describe the evolution is to say that we're still, as I said, looking for the correct mathematical tools. We clearly do not have them yet. But it's not really a mathematical problem because it has a physical side. One way to say what the physical problem is, and this is just one of the problems, is the following. We understand this picture here. We understand what strings do when we have small numbers of them and they're interacting slowly, so one breaks and a little while later the two come together again. That we understand well. What we don't understand well at all is when we have many strings at once, like in the bottom picture, and the splitting and joining, this interaction is happening fast enough that you can't break it, separate it into one, then another, it just kind of happens all at once. So this we understand well, this we don't. And this is important for being able to make precise predictions from string theory, because we have to solve this problem. Essentially, because strings are so very small, that's the basic reason, we can never find experimentally an environment where this is happening all by itself in a clean way. Everything we see is taking place in a background, something like this. That's maybe overstated, but everything we see taking place in the background where interactions of many strings are happening rapidly. And so in order to go from the theory we know to precise predictions, we have to be able to solve this problem. Now there's been progress there. There's been progress there just in the last 5 years. New tools, not a complete set of new tools, but new tools for dealing with just this problem. And I won't be able to describe the tools, but I'll describe one of the things that we've learned from it. What we seem to have learned is that strings are actually not the end. There is an end, I think, but strings are not the end. When we finally know what string theory is, it won't be about strings. I don't know if I want to say smaller things still. It's not clear where it's going. We don't know where it's going. But here's sort of one thing, again, that gives a flavor. We've learned that string theory has other structures, in particular structures known as D-brains. And one possibility, I'm not trying to explain the names like color and flavor and D-brains, even though I'm responsible for this one, because the history of them isn't important. That's what they're called. But in any case, string theory has these other structures. And one possibility is that a string really looks something like this, namely more like a necklace, where the little beads on the necklace are these things called D-brains, which are joined by little bits of string. Now, this is not really the right picture. This is a very crude approximation to the truth, but it gives you the flavor of it. And so when we have small numbers of strings interacting weakly, the picture we understood, that the string picture is fine. But from investigations of these cases of many strings, it appears the better description, the more complete description, is in terms of something else. And if you had to answer today the question, what is the something else, you would say D-brains, but maybe next week we'll understand things a little bit better still. Now, since it's not string theory, we need a new name for it. And here are various things that have been put forward. The theory formerly known as strings has been used many times. M-theory. What does the M stand for? Well, that's a deliberately ambiguous name because we don't know what the theory is. M could be membrane, matrix, magic. I think I misspelled magic. Mystery, mother. U-theory has started to catch on, where U is unknown or er. Most of the time, we just call it string theory because whatever it is, it contains those parts of string theory that we understood. They're still there. It's just the parts that we didn't understand. The picture is perhaps rather different than we thought it was. Okay, so it's an evolving theory, and even its name is evolving. So my final point is black holes. So we, again, to test, to understand this unification of quantum mechanics and gravity, we have to look in places where both are important, and that requires an extreme environment. And there are very few places more extreme than the inside of a black hole. I'll tell you what those problems and puzzles are, but string theory, if it is in fact the correct theory that incorporates both quantum mechanics and general relativity, should resolve these puzzles. Here is a schematic picture of a black hole. It looks very much like the picture that Kip drew. And it has two notable places. It has the singularity, the place where the collapsing star ended up. This is a point of infinite curvature. It's a place where Einstein's equations break down and we don't know what happens. In addition, there's a place up here which is less dramatic, at least initially, but in the long run is very important, because once you're past this point, the event horizon, you're doomed to fall into the singularity. You can't escape. That's the point of no return. Even light can't escape past this point. So there are puzzles concerned with both the singularity, which I'll talk about first, and puzzles that are related to the event horizon. Okay, the puzzle related to the singularity is what I said. Einstein's equations break down there. The various terms in Einstein's equations are all infinity, and the equation doesn't tell you what space-time does at the singularity or past the singularity. Now, string theory has not yet solved this problem, but it's solved related problems. In fact, there are many, many kinds of singularity. It's hard to draw them all, but there are classifications of singularity. There are many, many kinds of singularity. Some are worse than others. The black hole singularity is about the worst there is, in part because not only is it singular, but once you get near it, you're doomed to fall inside it. There are other singularities which are a bit more mild. And indeed, in many cases, it's been possible using this machinery, which this machinery which takes 900 pages to explain, using this machinery, 900 or more, in fact, one finds that the equations of string theory, although the equations of general relativity fail to make sense at this point, the equations of string theory make perfect sense. Out here, away from the singularity, it looks pretty much like general relativity, because that's the way string theory is. It has to reduce to general relativity in the regions where general relativity works. But when you get close to the singularity, when you get kind of within a string's size of the singularity, then the picture is different, and in particular, the singularity is smoothed out. We don't yet understand this for the black hole singularity, but again, for some others, we do. So this is another one of the long-standing problems of gravity, and string theory provides a partial solution. I should mention a recent popular book by Brian Greene, The Elegant Universe. It has a longer title, if that's the first part of it. It's one of the very small number of popular books on string theory, and in particular, it focuses on just this kind of issue, the way the string theory changes our picture of geometry. Okay, so that is the problem with the singularity. What is the problem with the horizon? Well, this is what Stephen Hawking talked about in part, and I will repeat some of what he said. There are two things that were learned about the horizon in the 1970s. We learned these things partly or entirely due to Stephen Hawking's work. The first is that there's a close analogy between the laws of black hole mechanics and the laws of thermodynamics. For example, and Kip discussed this somewhat, the total area of the event horizon always increases, and there's a similar law in thermodynamics that the entropy always increases. Now that's a pretty small analogy, but in fact the analogy is much more complete than that. It's a very striking analogy. Now the laws of thermodynamics were eventually explained by the atomic theory. In fact, the thermodynamics, I think, was one of the clues which led to the atomic theory. This analogy suggests that there should be a corresponding atomic theory of black holes, that in some sense black holes or the black hole horizon should have some sort of atomic structure. Also, in this analogy between thermodynamics and black holes, in the atomic theory, the entropy of a system has to do with its disorder, the number of states, the number of different states that its atoms can be in. So there should be an atomic picture of the black hole horizon with the property that the horizon area, the area of the event horizon, is related to the amount of disorder in those atoms. And Stephen actually mentioned this, and I will say it again. String theory has now been shown to have just this property. This is the work of the past few years. Now, I've drawn a picture here. What I've drawn is the outside of the black hole, and at the horizon, I stopped and drawn these D-brains that I talked about, these new structures in string theory. This is a very bad picture. This is not the right picture. One of the reasons this is a very bad picture is this is a classical picture. Everything is sitting still. And in fact, in this system, there are very strong quantum mechanical effects. These things are undergoing very large quantum fluctuations, and I don't know how to draw a quantum picture. In fact, early in the day, David, I think, mentioned how we sit around and talk a great deal, and one of the things we talk about a lot is what's the right picture to draw. If we knew what the right picture was, it would be a major guide in bringing things together, in understanding what is the right mathematics, or what is it that we're seeing. We don't have the right picture, and this is certainly not it. Okay, so there are these new structures in string theory, which in some sense are the atoms of which the black hole horizon is made, and there's a very precise calculation that one can do that has been done of the amount of disorder in this system, and in fact the number is just precisely the same number that Bekenstein and Hawking got 25 years ago from the analogy with thermodynamics. So this is yet another of the long-standing problems of quantum gravity that we finally seem to be understanding. Now, I should say something here. Stephen called these, there are two differences here from what Stephen said. First of all, he called them P-brains, and I'm calling them D-brains. I think that this is because secretly Stephen believes that the correct name for the theory of everything is supergravity. But in fact, well, the two names, these are the same objects. These two things are the same thing by different names. Secondly, he described them as sheets, and I'm drawing them as points. And that is just because I'm making a long story short. They can assemble themselves, in effect, into different geometries. And so it's the same thing. Okay. There's one more, finally, puzzle having to do with quantum mechanics and black holes and the horizon. And again, this is one that Stephen mentioned. And so I'll just draw a cartoon of it. Black holes are not really black. Due to quantum effects, due to these quantum fluctuations near the horizon, radiation can escape and carry with it energy. And because of that, the black hole gets smaller in time, and eventually when all of its energy is radiated, it disappears entirely. Now, actually, for a black hole that's formed from a star, for a really big black hole you can observe, this process is enormously slow and would take far longer than the life of the universe to occur. But you can imagine smaller black holes which could be made in other ways, such as the Big Bang, and those could evaporate over a time scale that you could see. Now, you start with a star, and it turns into a black hole, and eventually it turns into Hawking radiation. And the final outgoing Hawking radiation loses complete track of what went into the black hole. For example, if in addition to the star, I threw a dictionary in, well, a dictionary has a lot of information in it, but in the end, the Hawking radiation would be just exactly the same. That information would be erased from the universe. Now, this is inconsistent. This information loss, this erasure of information, is inconsistent with the laws of quantum mechanics. And again, Stephen was the one who pointed this out over 20 years ago. And for 20 years, it's been a problem. And there are two obvious solutions. One of them is to modify quantum mechanics so as to allow information loss. So if information loss is inconsistent with quantum mechanics, the problem is with quantum mechanics. Change quantum mechanics. The second is to find some way that the information can be preserved, can be imprinted on the outgoing Hawking radiation. And this is not easy. Again, it requires some severe modification of general relativity, some severe modification of the nature of space-time, such as to allow information to be imprinted. For 20 years now, many people from general relativity, from particle theory, have thought about this question, have thought about it hard, and have come down on one side or the other of the issue with no consensus. In fact, to good approximation, you could predict a person's stand on this issue if you knew who their thesis advisor was. It wasn't really a scientific issue then. Now, there finally seems to be progress. It's not certain, and as Stephen said, it's not certain. We do not have the entire picture, but the direction seems to be towards preserving quantum mechanics and towards a modification of space-time which allows the information to escape. And that's again this same picture. These atoms, these D-brains, which live on the black hole horizon, not only have some disorder that accounts for this thermodynamics, they also can store and re-radiate information. Again, we don't know the precise details of how this occurs. The equations say it occurs. We have quantum mechanics. We have a complete quantum mechanical description of this system in which information is preserved. What we don't have, what it would take to really satisfy Stephen, is the picture of exactly what's going on and how the theory of general relativity is modified so as to allow this to happen. We don't have that yet, and that's clearly something that we're trying to find. Okay, I've never done this before, and I seem to have finished quite early. But because this is science, I should remind you that in the end, we certainly do hope that in spite of all the fun that we're having with these theoretical ideas, that we would like to see experimental tests of the theory. There's a serious chance of the discovery of one piece of the theory, not the entire theory, but one of these ingredients that went to explain the patterns in the standard model, supersymmetry. A very serious chance that will be discovered in the next 10 years and make everyone, theorists and experimentalists, very happy. Beyond that, we still need to move in this direction of improved theoretical understanding, better mathematical tools, which might, we hope, enable us to make precise predictions of the particle properties, maybe make predictions for early cosmology, and best of all, lead us to surprises that we haven't expected yet. Thank you. Oh, let's see.
The kind of information that's lost in
the
black hole, that's
no, that's the only thing that's not. That's the only thing that's not lost. But the dictionary is a nice example. You know, there's detailed information in there. You could write something in there, and yet the final state of the Hawking radiation would not depend on what was thrown in. So, it's also information in the thermodynamic sense, but. The only thing that's not lost is knowledge of the mass and the angular momentum and the charge. Those are the only things that are preserved by this process.
Yes.
That's a good question. That's a very good question. I'm not sure there's a simple answer because some of these particles, such as the graviton, are their own antiparticles. Roughly speaking, right, The particles which have antiparticles, in some sense, have their oscillation kind of has a direction of rotation, and so the antiparticle rotates in the opposite direction.
You have a rotating
string
which has opposite.
Well, yeah, it's not. It's not just the spin, it's kind of an internal rotation, but it's in that sense, yeah.
And that gives you opposite charge?
Yes, that's right, because all of these things have different charges. Their charge, in some sense, comes from their state of vibration. And in particular, yeah, you can ask, what is the particular thing about their state of vibration that distinguishes one charge from another? And it's indeed some state of rotation, and if you ask, is that spin, I have to kind of whisper that, no, it's actually spin in some additional dimension. And I didn't talk about that because I didn't think I'd have so much time. So I'll stop.
Okay. Why did did you choose closed strings and not open strings?
That's a good question. The simplest theories, the ones that seem to work best, the heterotic string, which David discovered or invented, I think discovered, has closed strings. But in fact, with the improved understanding recently, these things are all on more or less the same footing. So I just do a closed string to cut down on the amount of words I had to say.
One of the things we did was we looked at the fact that horizon area of black holes, along with entropy,
yes,
and that's comparable to entropy along with entropy. Okay, so how does this drive? Maybe I'm not clicking here. How does that drive the evaporation?
That's a great question. That's a great question. I'm glad you asked it because it jives perfectly for the following reason. And it was, in some sense, it's the final question that makes the thermodynamic analogy fall into place. The black hole gets smaller, but it emits radiation.
Right.
There's entropy in the radiation. This is hot radiation.
Right.
So in fact, what really increases is the sum of the horizon area and the entropy of radiation.
Okay.
So in fact, it's more good. So in fact, it's really more than an analogy. The fact that Hawking radiation makes it more than an analogy because you actually have to add these two things together to get something which increases. Thank you.
Yeah, what is it about the topology of the string that, you know, makes it really useful? I know you don't want things to diverge, similar to some of your other particle theories. Where does that closed topology stop divergence?
Well, roughly speaking, the problem with space-time foam was that our particles, including the graviton, were points. They were zero size, so we could talk about things that were as small as you like. Because the string has a size, it provides an end to that. So it's simply that. It's the fact that it's an extended object.
Why is the information law such a problem for quantum theory? Why do you have to hold on to quantum determinism?
It's because if you try to modify the laws of quantum mechanics so as to take this into account, the real reason they get uglier. I mean, you know, all of us think quantum mechanics is kind of weird, and we would be happy if someday it were explained, it were made simpler or more intuitive. Information loss modifies it, but not in a way that makes us happy. It modifies it in a way that seems ugly. It may even be mathematically inconsistent, but it modifies it in a way which too. I'm sorry, when I say us, I mean those of us with the appropriate thesis advisors. And so while, you know, we'd be happy to see quantum mechanics improved, this seems to be a step in the wrong direction.
Yeah, we've actually come across material that wasn't discarded since symmetry. Do you work since symmetry in your...
Discarded in what sense?
They didn't even take into account when they explained string theory. They completely just left it out.
It's an important part of the structure of the theory. There, you can ask Ben, there's a question, you know, it's up there at this very short distance where strings are. There's a question, what do we actually see experimentally? It's a so-called broken symmetry. There are many symmetries which are symmetries of the building blocks, but which we don't see in nature because of a phenomenon known as symmetry breaking. I don't know if that's what they were talking about, but there is a major question whether supersymmetry will be visible at a scale particle accelerators can reach, which seems like the most likely alternative, or whether it's going to be invisible up to very high energies. Maybe we could talk later. I don't know what the issue was.
You mentioned singularities other than black hole singularities.
Yes.
Can you just say a little bit about that?
Yeah, the simplest is the tip of a cone. Imagine an ice cream cone. The tip of it is a sharp point. It's not like a black hole singularity. There's nothing that sucks you down to the tip, but it's a point where space is no longer smooth but has sharp curvature, and it's a place where Einstein's equations don't make sense. If you have a universe that has, you know, space with an ice cream cone sticking out upside down. Now, it's that kind of thing, and again, there's a classification of these things. There are many different kinds, but that's an example.
So a breaking, for example, of a closed loop string, if you're describing it as a particle, would describe in some way radioactive decay, breakdown of particles into smaller.
That's right. Any decay. Well, not, it has to be a decay of the basic building blocks. Actually, the simplest involve. Well, an electron emitting a photon. That's the simple one. An electron emitting a photon, the basic process in electrodynamics is one string breaking into. And one string oscillates this way and it's an electron. An electron, one string oscillates that way and it's a photon. Exactly. Yes.
What's behind the quantum design dimensional analysis?
Well, it's really true that the most important thing in any physical system is dimensional analysis. I could write down for you a calculation of just what I wrote down there, the size of the quantum fluctuations and how they affect the motion of particles, and I could do some integrals, and I could say they're this big. But in fact, if I look at what goes into that final answer, the integrals and the factors of 2 and the pi don't make much difference. It's just those constants. So you know, there's obviously a calculation that one can do. Talking again about the propagation of particles in this background, but the important part is just the dimensional analysis.
You said that distances less than the Planck length probably do not exist.
Yes.
Then could you say that length is quantized?
No, that's a good question. That's a very good question, because it's always been a possibility long before string theory that there was a limit to distance. And you think about, what does that mean? And one of the possibilities that comes to mind is just what you said, that maybe space is a grid which gives you sharply quantized length. That doesn't seem to work. It's something more subtle than that. It's more like, take the grid and now let it be dynamical and fluctuate all over the place. And the minimum length has to do with the density of those grid points, but they're not fixed in any regular pattern that would give you a sharply quantized length. That's a crude picture, but there is not going to be any quantization to that shortest length.
So the same thing would be true of space-time.
Yeah.
How would string theory help to explain virtual particle pair creation?
String theory includes quantum mechanics. I'm not sure whether it's more correct to say that string theory is inside quantum mechanics or quantum mechanics is inside string theory, but the theory of nature as we now understand it is based on the laws of quantum mechanics such as they've been for the past 70 years, and virtual pair creation is one of the implications of those laws. There's no further explanation beyond what we already had.
Yeah, where did the mathematics of Ramanujan have an impact on string theory?
I'm probably the wrong person to ask, but in certain cases you have to sort of sum over all the possible states of the string, all the possible vibrations, and the kind of mathematics that Ramanujan was good at was exactly that kind of thing, sort of sums of things that are built out of integers. That's far from the only interesting mathematics, and it's far from being the most interesting mathematics even in string theory, but that's where it came in.
If the quantum length represents sort of a smallest piece of the universe you can look at, are there important questions about what that's like?
Well, I mean, one of the most important is the universe is getting bigger, which means as you go into the past, it was getting smaller. And we can follow this back in a fairly quantitative way very far. Inflation, which is supposed to have occurred at very high energies, very early times, is quantitatively testable in the microwave background. But that's still not back as far as the Planck scale. One of the things a complete theory should do, besides giving the laws of motion and the particle types, you would hope is give the initial conditions, explain how it all started. And so perhaps the most interesting question about the Planck length is, what did the universe look like when it was Planck-sized, and how exactly did it start? And that's something we would certainly hope to be able to answer. But trying to address that question now with the tools being such as they are, it's more just playing with things. Nothing has come out of it yet.
You said different state of vibrations make a different fundamental particle. Mm-hmm. Why is it that there would only be 18 different harmonic states?
Ah, a very good question. A very good question. Gosh. Do I have time for another transparency? Okay. So one of the secrets I didn't mention is that space has more than three dimensions. And the idea is this. What is that thing up there? It's a line. It has one dimension. You can move this way. So we see three of those. You can move this way, this way, and this way. But what if I were to magnify it and tell you that it really looked like this, where there are three really long dimensions, 10 to the 10th light years or more, and to pick a random number, 7 really short ones around that same size as before. First of all, this is a perfectly good solution to Einstein's equations. Space-time can bend in general relativity, and it can bend into this shape. In fact, since the dimensions that we see were once much smaller, it's quite possible they were all once this small, and three of them, for some reason we don't yet understand, only three of them expanded. Now, as you can kind of guess from this picture, if these are small enough, you don't see them in any direct way, but they can have important indirect effects. And this in fact was one of those unifying ideas that came before string theory. In fact, it came even before general relativity. Because you can start with a space-time like this, and now if you have a particle, depending on whether it's vibrating this way or vibrating this way, it looks like two or more different kinds of particles. So it's a way to get more building blocks from fewer. It's this unifying idea. In the case of strings, when I told you that they can vibrate, well, they can vibrate not only in the three directions we see, but in these other 6 or 7. So now, the details of the spectrum that we see depend on the number and shape of extra dimensions. So the 18 comes from sort of the counting of the modes of vibration in this larger space. It depends in detail on the shape of the space, and I'm only counting there strings, states that are light enough to be seen in particle accelerators. I'm not counting states which are very much heavier. There's an enormous... A string has an infinite number of ways it can oscillate. Why aren't there an infinite number of particles? Because most of them are very heavy. The only ones you see are ones in which the oscillations are small enough that that it's light, and you can count them, and 18 is the answer for a shape, for a space of a certain shape. Time is one of the big... Time is one of the big ones. I didn't draw it. People sometimes ask, what would happen if we rolled up time? And we all go, duh. I mean, you know, it's a hard question to ask. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
Time is one of the normal ones.
Right. Yes?
Why is there exactly one dimension that's time-like? Does the string theory have any comments on that kind of question?
It's a real good question. It's very hard to make any sense of physics. You know, physics is at one level about differential equations, about sort of taking the system and following what it does as time moves forward. It's very hard to make sense mathematically, much less physically, of motion when you have two time directions to move in. And so you could try. No one can stop you from writing down string theory with two times, but I wouldn't know what it meant. I wouldn't know how to interpret it in terms of physics. It's a real good question. It's just that one time dimension is basically the only place that you can live. If there's no time dimensions, nothing happens. And if there's two or more, you can't make sense of it.
Well, I think we should go into the problem. We are going to run the boxes. If there's some issues before I say a final word, we're going to run boxes from now until the last person is here, so you can bug Joe some more if you want. I'd like to just end by thanking you all for coming. I'm sure you sound like you had a great time, and we enjoyed watching you. All of us, the speakers, the organizers, even staff, all the hard work, enjoyed just seeing your enthusiasm and enjoying the respect. So we look forward to seeing you.